studies have shown that staying up for more than 18 hours at a time puts your mind and your body, your physiologic processes, under the same impairments as having a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05%, which is approximately 3 to 4 drinks in the average male in a couple hours, and then 2 to 3 drinks in a female.
Bonjour, friends, and welcome to Whole Body Optimism for Healthcare Professionals, the podcast that's all about embracing a modern approach to positivity, clean living, and personal growth. I'm Dr. Chrissy, and I'll be your guide on this journey to a happier, healthier, and more optimistic you. All right, everybody, I'm so excited today to have here Dr. Angela Holiday Bell. She is a board-certified sleep specialist and a founder of the Solution is Sleep LLC. She helps people live happier, healthier, and more productive lives through the benefit of better sleep. She digs deep into this and finds the root cause of why your sleep issues exist, and also helps you address and reform maladaptive thoughts and behaviors that interfere with quality sleep. Let's hear from you firsthand. Tell us, I know there's a lot of listeners out here that are medical students, trainees, even healthcare professionals, not in a physician role or whatnot. Tell them, how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah. That's a great question, because I actually have a very interesting story. So I decided at a very young age, at the age of 6, that I wanted to be a doctor, but specifically a baby doctor. And I decided that, stuck with it throughout my life, went to college, was a pre-med, and then actually did a 1-year master's after college in biotechnology because I thought I wanted to do research.
Oh, wow.
Realized in that I did not want to do research. And then I did medical school for 4 years, and then residency. During my pediatric residency, for those who are in it, you understand, if you're not, very rigorous experience working 80 plus hours a week, 24 to 36 hour shifts. That is when I started to suffer from insomnia. So it really was the worst and most frustrating experience I've ever experienced. And so I was like, okay, this is not going to work for my life. I need to make a change. So I just started reading every book there was about sleep. I started volunteering in the sleep clinic in my hospital just to fix my own sleep. And in that process, I fell in love with sleep. And I was like, oh gosh, wait a minute. There's so much more to this sleep thing than just feeling rested or not feeling irritable. It really is so key to the optimal functioning, both mentally and physically. So I decided then and there that I also wanted to practice in sleep. So after residency, after I took my pediatric boards, I became certified as a clinical sleep specialist, and it started with just consulting with individuals who are struggling with sleep. I used a lot of what I learned in my practice as a pediatrician, but then it grew from there, and I started to get more into sleep and more people asking me about it in companies and corporations. And so I decided to start my own business. But yeah, that is what has led me to where I am now as a sleep specialist.
Awesome. So just for the technical aspects for maybe the learners out there, you finished the pediatrics boards and whatnot. Did you have to do an extra fellowship to become a sleep specialist or a test? How did that go?
Yeah, I did not have to do so. I actually toyed with the idea of doing that. There's a sleep medicine fellowship where you are a sleep medicine. I did not do that though. In the sleep clinic, I was talking with the fellows, and it really came down to two things. One, I was very, very interested in the behavioral aspect of insufficient sleep. A lot of it comes down to behaviors and chronic insomnia. Obviously, sleep disorders like sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome are super important and play a role, but a lot of it, even in the setting of those disease states, comes down to behavioral insomnia. And so I wanted that to be my main focus. I did have to learn how to read sleep studies, and I did all that, but I had no interest in staying up overnight to continue to do that. And then the other thing was that I also wanted to be a pediatrician. So I actually didn't want to give that part up and be just a sleep medicine physician.
Oh, wow.
So there is a specialty called Certified Clinical Sleep Health Specialist that is given by the Board of Registered Polysomnographic Technologists.
Wow.
That has pathways to obtain that. One is if you already have an advanced medical degree. So this is really for MDs, RNs, who also want to specialize in sleep. And then there's a way for people who don't have that. If you already have that specialized degree, you do have to sit for a board exam from the Board of Registered Polysomnographic Technologists. You have to learn how to read sleep studies. You have to prove that you have knowledge in the sleep conditions. So there is like a training process and like a manual, but you sit for the board exam and get certified that way. So that was the route that I chose.
Wow. So that's a lot of knowledge about sleep, and that's super impressive. And I'm sure you see all different types of ages, ranges, and what's your typical demographic? Is it more like your young professionals that have too much on our minds, or what?
Absolutely, yeah. So that part, young professionals who are trying to excel in the workplace or are excelling in the workplace, but not so much when it comes to wellness and self-care and sleep and all that comes along with it. I really do focus on the interrelationship between work and sleep because I think there is such a big and strong bi-directional relationship between where and how you work and how you sleep, as was the case for me in developing my insomnia, and then how you sleep and how you work. So really meeting people where they are and how they live and how they work and how that relates to their sleep.
Wow. I mean, that makes sense. I think about this a lot, and because whenever I was doing some locums and I had to do night shift. And I know there's a lot of people that are listening that are mostly do night shifts, even like 3 days a week or 4 days a week. How does that, like you talk about that work relationship, how does that, do you coach people differently that work nights or days? And tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
Yeah, I do. So night shift has a significant impact on sleep. It what I would say is the best thing we do for our sleep and health is to not work night shift or rotating shifts, you know, in all honesty. As a resident, for instance, we were doing the worst thing that we could to our sleeps and our health, honestly, with working nights and then days and then 24-hour shifts and 36-hour shifts. There's no way to really reinforce your circadian rhythm when you're constantly switching up. However, what we have learned is there are ways that you can do it in a healthy way and in a way that is going to be the next best thing to kind of having the consistent daytime schedule. Particularly if your schedule is nights, it becomes a little bit more challenging when you're doing a rotating schedule, even though there are to manage that. So when I'm talking to individuals who work night shifts, it really is about keeping as much consistency as they can between the nights that they work and the nights that they don't, and then having what we call anchor sleep. So this is ideally about a 4-hour window that people would spend sleeping, whether they're working or whether they're not working. So what often happens is people who work the nighttime shifts will work night shifts, and then on their days off, they try to be a daytime person. Like, oh, now I'm up all day and sleeping at night, and it's very difficult for your circadian rhythm to make those quick changes. So instead, we say try to anchor your sleep around a 4-hour period where, whether you're working that night or not, you will definitely spend those 4 hours sleeping. And then the other 4 hours can kind of flux around that. And that kind of gives your circadian rhythm something to anchor to, makes you more productive at work, but then also more alert during the daytime and allows you to enjoy more normal social hours during the day. Because obviously it doesn't sit well with people to say, oh, on your days off, also the so like that's not, you know, realistic. So it gives them more time to be social, but also anchors their circadian rhythm so they don't have all of the same effects from completely switching each time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I really like that. I hadn't heard that before, but that makes sense. So, what about you? So, you overcame your insomnia, and how did you make the transition? Did you pick up some tips and then you felt better? And then how did that transition work?
Yeah, absolutely. So I really focused on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, and I kind of took my, and then I became certified in that as, or trained in that as well, I should say, because that was such a significant impact on my sleep. And so it was me learning those therapeutic techniques, applying them, seeing like, oh, this works, and like I can sleep, and now I feel so much better. And then deciding, like, I was like, I have to tell people about this. During residency, I actually started a blog, like while I was still a resident, about, because I was like, people need, like, not enough people know. People need to know about how important this is. And then it kind of grew from there as I was like, I have to spread the word.
Now, I know some of the listeners that are here, they don't know what cognitive behavioral therapy is. I'm very familiar with it, but can you break that down for people and let them know, like, is this a standard of care for insomnia? Tell us what you think.
Yeah, let's start there. So cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is actually the gold standard treatment for chronic insomnia now, even over prescription medications. And that's because we found in research that it has at least the same results in terms of improvements in sleep on prescription sleep medications, but less side effects and longer lasting effects. And basically what this means is, you know, there are people who have intermittent sleep problems or short-lived sleep problems, and that's okay. We don't expect you to have perfect sleep every night. But if you have difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking up earlier than intended at least 3 nights per week for at least 3 months, now you've fallen into the realm of chronic insomnia. And your typical sleep hygiene things are generally not going to cut it in order to help you improve from that. That's where cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia comes in. It basically identifies the maladaptive thoughts that you have surrounding sleep and the subsequent behaviors that occur as a result of that. And we kind of unravel those things and retrain your brain on how to sleep. And a lot of it comes down to sleep anxiety as well. So people have learned that sleep is this contentious process fraught with so much anxiety and stress. And then whatever was the initial trigger for the insomnia, it's not even about that anymore. It's about this battle between your brain and sleep. And so we have to retrain our brain to understand that sleep is a passive process. It's a process you should look forward to. We have to, you know, help ourselves overcome that anxiety. And then we use some therapeutic techniques to help do that along the way.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that is just, I use some apps for CBT. And do you recommend, or what do you personally use to help yourself go to sleep now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have my routine down pat. First of all, I think the biggest thing when it comes to getting adequate sleep is consistency. Consistency is key in terms of your routine, in terms of the time you're waking up in the morning is actually the most important thing when it comes to consistency, and ideally the time that you're going to bed. So I really had to learn to be more intentional about that. So my bedtime, my wake times are set all 7 days of the week, including the weekends. And then when it comes time for bed, and this is something that really helped a lot during residency, is I have a dedicated bedtime routine and I give myself and my brain that time to wind down and transition to sleep. And so that means getting rid of screens. Like I put my phone on do not disturb. I'm not looking at stimulating things like social media or the news or talking to people or texting. I light candles, I dim the lights, I put on soothing music, I do like a skincare routine, I do a devotional, read whatever book I'm reading at the time, and then fall asleep. And I try to keep those steps the same. And so as soon as I started, my brain is like, oh, okay, this is sleepy time. Like we're getting to the good stuff. And so now I have it kind of down pat, but it took a while for me to train myself to do that. And I think, too, it started with the mindset of prioritizing sleep. Like I had to decide that sleep was going to be more important than me binge watching my show or scrolling through social media because I needed to feel, you know, and be my best the next day. And so a lot of it starts with that mindset and that intentionality around your sleep.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you did this during residency. So for the residents that are listening, this is your hallelujah moment saying you can get sleep in residency. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the culture of sleep, and especially for trainees. What do we have to do to highlight these sleep factors to administration, to chairs, to whoever? What, I mean, tell us a little bit about the health risk of lack of sleep.
There are so many health risks, and it is very unfortunate in the way that we train. I think it's just so ingrained in medical training that like when residents truly lived in the hospital, which is why they're called residents, and you are on all the time and people feeling like that has to be the case in order for you to learn. And that just isn't true. But when you think about the health effects, things like weight gain, starting there, when you're not getting enough sleep, your hormone that causes you to feel hungry, ghrelin, is actually released in higher quantities. At the same time, the hormone that signals that you're full, leptin, is released in lower quantities. You also have your executive functioning is not operating as well. So it's harder to think through your decisions. So you really want that instant gratification. So you're more likely to eat foods that are more highly processed and high in sugars. You're eating more of it because you're hungrier, leading to weight gain. You are triggering your body's fight or flight stress response system. So that cortisol is being released all the time because your body's like, if I'm not sleeping, that must mean that we're under some sort of threat, because why would we not be taking part in this restorative process? So let's make sure we're on high alert so we can respond to the threat if necessary. We all know that long term increase in inflammation is not good for your body. Increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. That high cortisol decreases insulin sensitivity, increasing your risk of type 2 diabetes. And then there is a significant increase in mental health conditions like anxiety and depression when you're not getting enough sleep or when you have insomnia. So there are so many effects. If nothing else, studies have shown that staying up for more than 18 hours at a time puts your mind and your body, your physiologic processes, under the same impairments as having a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05%, which is approximately 3 to 4 drinks in the average male in a couple hours, and then 2 to 3 drinks in a female. And so We would not have trainees or doctors say, just a couple beers before you come to work and then take care of these patients.
Right.
Regularly ask them to stay up for more, well, you know, well above 18 hours of sleep. So it's one of the things I think is unfortunate, and it is so ingrained that I think it's going to take a lot to really kind of get us out of this state that we're in.
I truly wish that there was some kind of cultural change we can make, especially speaking from a surgery perspective. You know, trauma surgery is just, I mean, there's a lot of hospitals around there that are still just doing 24-hour shifts. Now, there is a change that a lot of places are making to the 12-hour shifts and doing that kind of shift work. But there's a lot of people a little bit older that think that if they did it, then we have to do it. And it just perpetuating this culture of sacrificing your own well-being and sleep to stay at the hospital longer. So I totally I think the future will change because we'll have more of a voice as more of us kind of get into the leadership roles that are seeing the health benefits of it. If we're expected to take care of patients for a long time, then wouldn't we want to be at our best? And I think our patients want that. They're starting to be more aware of it.
100%. And I think we're the ones that are giving this advice to patients, right? Sleep is so important. You should take care of yourself. Do all these things, but we're not living that out. So yeah, there's a lot of change that needs to happen there.
Right. Okay. So if someone who is listening who doesn't get good sleep, let's say I have a lot of people actually that talk to me about that they wake up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And maybe you get this a lot too, or you hear this. They get a workup and they don't have any kind of sleep disorder. What are some common recommendations that you're giving to people that are simple things that they could start tonight? What's free for them to start tonight? So what would you tell them?
Yeah. We call those people, or I call those people, being in the 3 a.m. club, because it always seems to be around 3 a.m. that this is happening. But the first thing I start with is, what are you doing when you wake up? Right? That's the first thing I ask. If you wake up at 3 a.m., what do you do? And the answer I get is, well, I look at my phone, I look at the time, I might start scrolling through social media, I might, you know, whatever. And what I then say is, you are effectively training your brain to wake up at 3 a.m. And the reason I say that is, first of all, we wake up multiple times throughout the night as we transition through sleep cycles, right? We go from light sleep to progressively deep sleep, REM sleep. There's a brief awakening, light sleep, or whatever. Oftentimes we don't remember the awakening. We may just change positions, fluff our pillow. Sometimes we do, whether it's because we have to get up and go to the bathroom, or where we had less of a sleep drive and it's getting to the early morning hours, such as 3 a.m., we may be more aware of that awakening. The problem is when you don't fall back asleep fairly quickly. And the issue is what people do during that time. So first of all, looking at the clock, whether it's your phone or an alarm clock, tends to trigger what we call a countdown anxiety. So you look at the time and you're like, oh shoot, it's 3 a.m. I have to get up at 6 a.m. I only have 3 hours to sleep. Okay, let me try to hurry up and go to sleep so I can get these 3 hours in. Then you're looking and you're like, oh shoot, now it's 4 o'clock. Okay, I only have 2 hours of sleep. All that does is get your brain waves going, works you up more and more. It makes it less likely that you're going to fall asleep. In addition, we grab these phones that are emitting this blue light a few inches from our face, scroll on social media. We stimulate ourselves and get those brain waves going. And then we feel like, oh, why can't I fall back asleep? To me, that's like having an alarm clock set at 3 a.m. because your brain is receiving signals that, oh, it's light. So it must be time to wake up, and we're getting stimulated. So it must be time to get up. So then you're actually teaching yourself that you want to be awake at 3 a.m. So the next night your brain's like, all right, let's go. 3 a.m. is when it's time to wake up. So the first thing is to understand that waking up is not a problem. If you wake up, totally fine. You can tell yourself, I've probably woken up a couple times throughout the night. It's okay. I'm going to fall back asleep. Don't look at the clock. I always say, if your alarm clock hasn't gone off, that means it's not time to wake up. So you don't need to know what. And then don't grab your phone. Instead, focus on doing some deep breathing exercises, listening to some soothing music, or for people who really struggle and they feel like, okay, I don't do any of those things, but inherently get worked up. Focus on staying awake. Set a different intentionality. Like, I'm not going to do anything, but my focus is not going to be on trying to force myself to sleep. Just taking that pressure away is often enough to help you fall asleep, because sleep is a passive process. So the more you try to do it, the more you force it, the less likely it's going to be to happen. So I recommend implementing some of those things if you're stuck in the 3 a.m. club.
Wow. I love those. Those are easy, simple to implement. And I think everybody would benefit from that. Now, I
Absolutely.
want to ask you something that I don't know if there's like much research done on this, but I know that sleep and fertility have been looked at. And I'm specifically interested in fertility because, you know, I talk a lot about it for whole body optimism and cleaning up your well-being to optimize all kinds of health issues, especially fertility. And there's studies that show that sleep, lack of sleep, can decrease sperm count. I know that sleep hasn't been looked at as much in women fertility, unless you know something, because it's kind of hard to count our eggs that are left to count that. But I do know whenever I was going through a lot of supplement changes in my fertility regimen, they were recommending melatonin. And so I always wondered, was what about natural melatonin? Would higher levels of natural melatonin help fertility and ultimately better egg quality or quantity, I don't know, rather than just the supplement by itself, and therefore more sleep was from more melatonin produced during the day, and you know, this ongoing cycle from serotonin, I'm sure you know all of these, but you know, like you need serotonin to make melatonin and all this other stuff. So curious your thoughts on that.
So you're absolutely right. What we've seen is insufficient sleep or insomnia significantly decreases a male's testosterone level and sperm count, and can make it, the testosterone level is about the same as someone 10 years older than them, so ages them. And we think the same thing happens with females, that there is some evidence to support decreased fertility, but like you said, it's not, we don't have those specific numbers quite as much. So you hit the nail on the head. When people talk to me about melatonin supplementation outside of a situation where their circadian rhythm is thrown off for some other reason, just for like nightly melatonin use, I always recommend ways to increase your natural melatonin production, because often our natural melatonin production is sufficient for what we need to fall asleep. But there are things that we do unknowingly that decrease that. So one of the first ways to improve your natural melatonin production is getting natural light exposure first thing in the morning within an hour of waking up. I think people don't understand the power of light and darkness as it pertains to sleep. Light is the strongest factor influencing your circadian rhythm in a way that tells you to be awake and alert. So when you wake up in the morning and you get that natural light exposure, it shuts off your melatonin release, which we want when we're trying to be awake and alert. It also increases your serotonin production, which is needed for melatonin production later. It helps to reinforce your circadian rhythm so that you're teaching yourself when to send those signals to wake you up in the mornings and when you want to be asleep at night. So natural light exposure is so important. If you can go outside and go for a walk, that's going to be the best. But if not, at least sitting by a window, or if you're somewhere like me in Chicago, where for the winter months, it's dark when I wake up, I use a light therapy box or light therapy glasses to simulate the natural light exposure. Similarly, though, when you go to sleep, you want your melatonin to be produced, and we often delay or inhibit that so much without knowing it. A lot of people are aware of blue light from your phones, and that's true. The blue wavelength of light has the strongest inhibitory impact on your melatonin release. However, existing in normal room lighting has been shown in research to also delay your melatonin release by up to 90 minutes, because that's still light exposure. You're still sending signals to your brain not to release melatonin, and that you want to be awake and alert. So literally before I start my bedtime routine, I have dimmers all throughout my house, but even if you don't, dim the lights. Use tableside lamps, light candles. You want to keep your light exposure low so that you can allow your melatonin to be released, and that will increase things. So just those two changes can significantly increase your natural melatonin production.
Wow. So everyone listening here, don't, your significant other is going to think something's up if you're like lighting a bunch of candles and turning a bunch of lamps on, turning the overhead lights on. But, you know, just tell them it's because you want more melatonin. Simple remedy here. Briefly, why don't you tell everybody, can they work with you if they want to?
Yeah, you certainly can. So to find out all things about me, my website, thesolutionissleep.com, but I have ways to work with me on there. I also have my book, Sleeping on the Job, that I kind of threw everything into, my heart and soul. So you can figure out how to get that or get in contact with me through other ways. So absolutely visit my website.
Awesome. Well, I know I'm going to be looking into that book and I'm going to be promoting it for myself and others around me. It was so lovely speaking with you today. I really appreciate all your tips. I think these are all just practical tips that everybody can use when they jump off of this podcast. They can go to their house tonight and start implementing some of these things. And I think it's important that we reflect on this. And if you're in a space that you have potential to change leadership positions in healthcare, really advocate for the learners and everybody that's around you. If you're a supervisor or a chair of a department or a division chief or something, ask the other people that work under you, are you getting good sleep? It's so important because I think the productivity that you're going to see when that's in front of you is going to be directly related to how many hours of sleep, or not even just hours, I would say, but the quality of the sleep that people are getting. So thank you so much again, and I look forward to staying in touch with you, and I will put the information to get in touch with you in the podcast notes. So thanks again, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us on this uplifting journey through whole body optimism for healthcare professionals. We really hope you found this episode today as enlightening and inspiring as we did. Remember, optimism isn't just a state of mind, it's a way of life. And you have the power to shape your own destiny. Be sure to follow us on this podcast and on Instagram and Facebook to learn more about practical and simple tips to find your true whole body optimism.